Nothing encouraged in the use of this concept for the peace officer. Take no direct impact on the peace we want. If you set the right down first, of course, your mind is peaceful. It's quite similar to lake again. A lake which is calm and peaceful doesn't have many waves. It's just looking at how peaceful your mind is. And so it doesn't have many waves. And the waves are basically what makes the thoughts. Anyway, first question, if a human dies, can she or he be reincarnated as a human being again? If yes, how this can happen? Does Buddhists believe in hell and heaven? How to explain this? It is something which I suffer even when I was growing up, so it's so obvious that people are just going to be reincarnated. Because the idea of just one life seems to be just so absurd, that people come into this world, you know, and they just have to learn everything all over again. Many mothers have told me when they give birth and look at a child who's just alive, it does come with history. They know it's not just a carbon copy of their partner and themselves. It's a totally different being. And there have been many examples of people who do recall their past lives. And to me it is just begs belief that rational people would ignore the very clear evidence which cannot be explained in any other way except that people have lived before. Many examples of that. I was just talking about one example, which became quite a well-known example, of quite a famous TV personality when I grew up in London. He was a comedian. His name was Roy Hudd, H-U-D-D. You can check this out on the internet if you really want to afterwards. He was an entertainer. That was his profession. And it happened one day that the local government in London had tried to improve traffic congestion by installing a new one-way system for central London. Like many people, this gentleman coming back from the theatre at night time got lost. He couldn't go his normal way home, so turning left here, turning right there, the only places he was allowed, he went to a part of London he'd never been to before. And when he turned his car down the street, hoping to find his way home down the street, he had never been to before in this life. The hairs on the back of his head stood up, because he started to remember that street. It was where he had lived in his previous life. And he came to the house where he had lived in his previous existence. He knocked on the door of the house, and because he was a reasonably well-known TV personality, the people in the house recognized him. What are you doing here? And that's when he said, I used to live here, in my previous life. And he took them around the house. He could recognize all of the modifications they've made, because he lived for years in that house before. But one of the reasons that story stands out, there's two reasons it stands out for me, was the first was that house had a blue circular plaque on the outside. For those of you who've been to London, you will find those plaques on the houses where famous people used to live. You go, this is where Winston Churchill is, a plaque on the outside. This is where Sir Alexander Fleming sort of found penicillin, discovered penicillin. That's a wonderful thing for people touring around London to see all these famous people you read about where they lived before. And that track was of another personality in the 1910s, 1920s, a music hall personality called Dan Leno, L-E-N-O. And he was that. He all his memories of being an entertainer in his previous life came back to him. And he's done many documentaries on the life of Dan Leno on TV, simply because he has more information about that person than anybody else. He was that man in his previous life. And that was the first interesting part of that recollection. He was an entertainer in his previous life, an entertainer in this life as well. But always when people mention their previous lives, there's always some sacrifice to make. And his sacrifice was being a well-known TV personality. He was contracted, I think, to one of the channels in UK, the head of whom was a very devout Catholic. And when this guy, Roy Hutt, wrote an article which was published and drew a lot of attention by the fact he could remember in great detail his previous life, he was released from that contract. He was sacked. His TV career took a very strong downturn. There are many people like that. For those of you who have read the research done by Stevenson, there's one, I think it's called, if I can remember, 20 cases supportive of reincarnation. I met one of those subjects when I was giving a talk in London, in the Sri Lankan Vihara, which was then in Heathfield Gardens in Chiswick. And he came up to me afterwards and said, I was one of those children who had spontaneous recall of my previous life. And the recall was so accurate, it actually matched the facts of this person who I claimed to be before. And there was no way I could get that evidence from anywhere else. He said, that was me. But he said that once that was publicized, he had such an awful time as a young boy in school. All his fellow students would tease him about his previous life. He's only maybe an 8 or 9 year old. How's your life today? What's your kids doing? Unfortunately, in many schools, anything which sets you apart from others is a source of bullying. And he was bullied quite mercilessly. He told me about it. He said that was the worst thing I ever did, was actually to tell people about my previous life. I suffered so much from that. I was different than the other boys. I was special. And I was hurt because of that. And when you see people and you hear about them and you talk to them, there's no doubt in my mind that what they're saying is the truth. They do remember those previous lives. And if 1 or 2 or 20 or 100 people can remember their past lives, that's the only explanation that they were born before. They lived before. And so if those people do, it'd be very weird if they were somehow special and you weren't born before. Reincarnation used to be part of Christianity. In 543 AD, I remember that number because in the Buddha was supposed to be in Thai tradition, 543 BC was when the Buddha was supposed to be his Parinirvana. That's why in Thailand, it's now 2017 by the Western calendar. You add 543 onto that to get the Thai year. So now it's 2560. So 543, I learned that number because you have to add that on to get the Thai year. And as Christ wants to retain thee, when the Pope, whose name at that time was Vigilius, was asked by the Emperor, the Roman Emperor at that time, who was named Justinian, I think he was still in Constantinople at the time, the Emperor Justinian asked the Pope to make reincarnation anathema, which means not part of the Christian theology. And the Pope refused. And the Emperor, as a result of the Pope's refusal, put the Pope in jail for 1 year. In those days, the secular authorities had far more power than the Popes did. So remember, Jones in those times did not have TV and nice food and air cons and comfortable beds to sit on or to sleep on. They were places of torture, and people, you know, would probably die out of ill health, bad food, too many rats around. So they brought the Pope in jail for a year, and only took a year, and the Pope gave in. Called the council, I think it was the fifth council of Nicaea, at which they pronounced that reincarnation was no longer part of the Catholic faith, and from that time on would be totally banned. It's interesting, 500 years of Christianity, reincarnation was just part of Christianity. Everyone accepted that, including the Pope, and the Pope was willing to go to jail for a year, but that's all he could take until he gave in. And then it was called an anathema. So it's not just an Eastern tradition, it was a Western tradition. And it was the press, not by the religious authorities, but by the secular authorities at the time, which is an interesting piece of information. Many people object, they want rational grounds. How can reincarnation happen when there's so many people alive today? In fact, it's a very simple calculation. I remember doing this in math class a long time ago. To prove beyond reasonable doubt there are more people alive today than have ever died on planet Earth. It's simple calculation. You just need to see the birth rate of human beings. And if there's more people alive than have ever died, where has everybody come from? It's a legitimate question, but the answer should be obvious. That human beings, animals, are not that far apart. Indeed, the scientist, you couldn't really call him a botanist or a chemist, because in these days, scientists did not really separate out the disciplines. They were what we call polymaths. They learned everything. And so this fellow was Linnaeus, L-I-N-A-E-U-S. I think he might be in Belgium, I'm not quite sure. Somewhere around that area. He was a person who started the concept of species. He looked at the natural world of beings, living beings, and he wanted to classify them according to different species of birds and reptiles and goodness knows what else. And he had his working hypothesis, which he wanted to apply to all beings to put them into the categories which we now call species. But in his last, letter or works, he said he always regretted not following through with the scientific principle of classification when it came to the three types of beings we call human beings, gorillas and chimpanzees, because to him they were all one and the same species. They belonged together. However, he admitted that if he'd been a scientist and stood his ground and just used logic and reason and had put those three types of beings together, his work would never get published. Because people thought that beings, human beings, were totally different than the other animals. But the truth of the matter is, we are far closer than most people think. So we are the same species. And so you understand now where many human beings have come from. The animal world, whether it's bears or tigers, elephants, gorillas, various types of primates, apes, their numbers have diminished as human beings have increased in their numbers. So it's very easy to understand where many human beings are coming. And that explains so many things. It explains Mr. Trump. Where did he come from? It explains your kids when you say they're little monkeys. You don't know how true your words could be. We have all these violent people, the terrorists, and the Hells Angels. They were gorillas in their past life. And there's a lot to be said for that. But not just first type animals, dogs and cats. Those of you who look after dogs and cats, you live with them, you notice how smart they are. They are highly intelligent. You don't need to read a dog's mind to know that they think each human being is so stupid. They have to work so hard, they have to stress out all day, and as a dog I can just sleep all day, I can just eat the finest of foods, I can sleep in a warm house, and I don't have to go to work and have a boss. All I have to do as a dog is to lick my owner every now and again, allow him to take me on a walk. When run my tail whenever he sees me or she sees me, that's all my responsibilities are. Who is a smart person? Who is the boss? And I think you all know that's just dogs, cats. Do you own the cats? Or do the cats own you? Who's the boss of the house? So anyway, there's not that much difference between these animals and human beings. But it's so obvious they can get reborn as humans, that's where they came from. It explains so much. So, to me, that as a scientist, I just really wonder why it is that scientists can't look at the evidence which is compelling. That there is such a thing as rebirth. And of course, some people, through either hypnotic regression, which is the easy way for some of you to access your past lives, or through meditation, which is a more accurate, powerful way, but only a few people can do that. You remember your past lives, who you were before, where you were before. And it's fascinating when people actually check that out. We have records which are accessible and you can find out who it was you were. Maybe in the second part of this retreat, or for those of you who go to Dharma going to those 9-day retreats, you get some really nice good meditation, and that's where you can start to find out about for yourself who you were before. When it's personal, there's no doubt that's in your mind at all. This thing actually is true. And it has consequences. You can But this one person, and I don't want to say who he is, but he is a Westerner. He found his past life, and it all checked out to his great surprise. And he said one of the first things he had to do once he recalled his past life and went to the libraries and it was all true, he said now he understood about rebirth from personal experience. He had to keep his five precepts. There was no choice for him anymore. So he liked having a beer, having some wine, and that was it. Afterwards, no more beer, no more wine, no more alcohol. He had to do service, not just for himself, compassion. It does change your life if you have direct recall of your previous existence. It also means the tragedies of this life, you lose someone, it's not such a big deal anymore. You die many times. Other people die many times. So grief loses its sting. It's not there anymore. So that's a wonderful thing. Now the question about heavens and hells. Yes, there are heavens and hells. And it's really easy to understand what they are and how they work. These are pre-existing places where you go to. Not like, say, Jhana Grove Retreat Center. It's there. You just go there. It's already existing for you. But heaven and hell realms, you make them. They are called Manomayakaya, mind-made realms. You construct them according to how you feel they should be, what you deserve. In heaven realms, imagine that you go up to heaven and get into trouble here as a Muslim, and you get your, I don't know how many virgins, 26 virgins. Imagine you're okay. What type of heaven would that be? So, you don't just get what it says in the books, it's what you think you deserve, your reward, and how you want it. It's one of the things which, you know, as a stupid young man, I thought, I don't want to go to Christian heaven. Because for me, Christian heaven was eating ambrosia, morning, evening, and lunchtime as well. Ambrosia, I like my fish and chips. But you didn't have fish and chips in heaven, just ambrosia. And you only had harp music. You never listened to a harp. It's nice the first time, it's pretty boring afterwards. I like rock music. I always thought that's where Elvis Presley went. So, you know, is he playing a harp or is he playing his guitar? What do you like? Until I realized that when I was very young, it's a stupid idea, but you realize that, and it's truth, how the Buddha described it. It's a made, tailor-made for you, and what you think you deserve. So I don't know what music you like, what food you like to eat. Maybe, I'm not sure, maybe in heaven is dim sum. With those people like ducklings. Julia. Which you can't eat in this hotel, I saw the sign in the rooms. But, you can eat whatever you want. So this is what you want, you talk again. And number two, like in hell realms, it's what you think you deserve. That is what you get. It's all about guilt. That's what makes the hell realms. You make them. And you stay there as long as you think you deserve. Uh-oh. Question, am I going too long? It's important. Okay. So this is one of those questions for you. I don't think it can be for Angie. She says, my boyfriend has commitment issues. enthusiasm. Now it's for somebody else. Commitment. What is the difference between commitment and involvement? Because when you have a relationship, you involve with somebody, but you know, it's not a true relationship. You have to be committed to a person to have a full relationship. And I often tell this, you know, first, Andy, who is that guy on the radio who used to do the uncommon sense? Remember, he had one up.
Mel Gill,
that's right. The old days when I used to give the talks at the British Fellowship and had enough energy. After giving the talks from 10 o'clock, you went to the media, what's it called? Video Corporation to do talk about radio. No, it wasn't. It was an interview or something from 10 to 12. And that's the first time I went there. I told this story to Mel, the difference between involvement and commitment. I say it's the same as the difference between bacon and eggs. In bacon and eggs, the chicken is only involved, but the pig is committed. You got it. And this Mel Gill, he literally, honestly, no exaggeration, he fell off his seat. He was on the floor, holding himself laughing. And he's making, I understood radio enough. If you go silent for too long, no one knows you're on air, and you get fined heavily. So I had to do a commentary. I said, your presenter is now incapacitated. I don't know if I can get invited, but I'm totally sort of discombobulated. But that's the difference between involvement and commitment. Why is it that people are, obviously it's fear, people have been hurt before, but there's also hurt with involvement as well. My teacher, Ajahn Chah, said, whatever you do, give it anything you've got, really get into it. If you just involve half-hearted, you only get sort of not even half the pay, and a quarter of the pay of that. You don't get any rewards. Whatever you do, really commit. Whatever you're going to do. Yeah, you get into trouble if you're committed, but it's usually in the end it's really good. I'm committed to being about 40, actually almost 40, come up to 43 years now. Haven't looked back at all. I'm really, I've had a wonderful time. And I commit to you guys as well. 11 years, executive retreat. And as long as I've got breath, and as long as you're not fed up with my silly jokes, you'll see me for another 11 years. So that's commitment. Now that's actually one of the reasons why burning down the monastery in Perth has been very successful. Because you're a known quantity, you've been there for such a long time, that you're trusted. You win trust through commitment. You're committed to something, you're committed to truth, you're committing to be a good man, committing to teach the best you can, then amazing things happen. So don't be afraid, don't be a nappy-pappy cream puff. Go for it, commit. You never lose out that way. Watch for one who he or has to face that his or her employer has reached the retirement age. 56 and you retire? That's unfair. This is my 66th year and I don't retire. What are you retiring for? So it doesn't make any sense. If you enjoy your job after 56 years, you probably know your job now. You've got all that experience. You should never retire. Maybe just work a little bit less. Maybe 3 days a week. A week or 4 days, but you should never retire. Because if you do retire, what happens? You end up volunteering for Bodhidharma, Buddhist Fellowship, Ram Center. You still have to work. So you might get paid for it. But it's not retiring. But anyway, your employer reach retirement age, 56 years. Shall the employee continue to be hired, or is it okay to let him or her retire while the employee still fit to work and to continue to work? Your karma benefit based on the labor, Lord, is a lump sum fee paid on the retirement day. That's why you won't let me retire. You can't afford to pay me off. But no, it's well, basically, I don't agree with retirement. But to me, work is your hobby, you can do what you like to do, what you love to do. So, and you can always make a contribution to yourself and others. Maybe just lessen the time you spend on work, maybe from 5 days to 3 days. But still, you've got too much to offer, too much experience. So why throw that away? So, now, the only time you can retire, real retirement, is when you're fully enlightened, just like a Buddha, and then you can retire. Before that time, you can still have work to be done. So that's a good retirement. Where does one go after his or her death? You go into your box. It's called a coffin. That's where you go. And I can prove that. That's evidence-based. How long before the reincarnation occurs after the death? Oh, that really depends. Sometimes people come back quickly. Sometimes it takes a long time before you come back. So, I don't know if I told this story. One of my monks, when you have many monks from different cultures, get really a good source of stories. And this fellow, he was from the Punjab. And he was grew up in a small village in the Punjab. Most people Sikh, S-I-K-H, the Sikh religion. And there's something you may have noticed there. Most Sikhs, their surnames, if they're male, are Sikh. And if they're female, I think it's something like Dur, D-U-R or something.
Kaur.
Kaur. So they all have the same surnames. So the only way you can differentiate people is from their first names. So that's an important part of the story. Because in his village, one of the old ladies died in the morning. Said to her, she was dead. And so they arranged the cremation for her. Gathered all the woods, get a priest to do the ceremonies. But before they could do the ceremony in the evening, she woke up, became alive. Scared of my husband, everybody. But that happened. When I told that story to a time, by the old time age, become 3 years, she said, same happened in actually her village. She saw this herself when she was a young girl. Somebody died, and they've been in the coffin for hours. And they had the monks were doing the chanting in the evening. They're going to cremate her the following morning. So they came and do the chanting. And while the monks were doing the death chanting, she opened her eyes and stood up, or just blinked up, and those monks ran so fast. She saw them. So ran for the monks. But anyway, this so this is because of course if that happened to me I would have sort of one. I hope. Try it out. So anyway, this lady, she woke up and she told the story of what happened. She said that when she died, from this out of body experience, these two not monsters, like demons, grabbed hold of her and dragged her to see this big boss demon, or the master of death, or whatever it was. And as soon as this master of death sort of saw these two lackeys, underlings, dragged this woman to it, You've got the wrong call. It's not this lady, it's another one. Because it's the same surname, I think maybe you've had the same first name as well, similar enough. They made a mistake, they got the wrong one. Take her back! So that's what you encountered, that's what you heard. So they took her back, and sure enough, about 5 minutes after she woke up, another old lady by a similar name, she died. They got the right one this time. So the moral of that story is make sure you don't have the same name as somebody else who's also old and sick in the hospital. Otherwise, you're not going to find God. Even if you're someone with the same name, please ask to be moved into another part of the hospital. So that's what I was thinking about. So those things sometimes do that, and that's just a very, very short time out. But, yeah, sometimes the, you know, people a long time before they pass away. And of course, that's where all the ghosts stories come from. But the ghost stories are really nice. Can I tell you one lovely story about the ghost dog? This is one of my really close old disciples. He does the time, not many people, the opening of, basically he does the opening of Charming Grove. We had an exhibition of the Thai boxing, and that was his fellow. His best friend was a builder. I think next door or somewhere really close by. So there were neighbours, and his neighbour had a lucky dog who would go to work with a builder every day. And the dog got sick and eventually took him to the vet, and the vet said had to give him the injection to use the nicer dog. So they did that, they used the nicer dog. They put him down. I don't know why they say put him down. It's killed, it's euthanized. I don't know if you remember that story of this person who took this huge, big golden Labrador to see the vet who was sick. And they got the vet, so picked it up and said, I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to put your dog down. Why? What's wrong with that? I didn't think it was that sick. I've got to put him down because he's heavy. another adventure I can't tell for years. This guy, he loved his dog so much. He took his dog to the vet, and the vet took one look at the dog and said, there's nothing I can do, your dog's dead. He's dead. He's already died. He said, no, he's not, he's just sick. This guy, no, he's dead. He's not, he's sick. Said the owner, because when you love your someone so much, you just can't accept, you're in denial. So the vet said, okay. So he put the dog on the table, and he went into another cage to get a cat. And he took this cat, and he had to hold the cat quite firmly, and put the cat's nose right in front of the dog's nose. You know what cats and dogs are like? The cat was hissing, you know, at this dog. The dog then moved. So he brought the cat to the back side of the dog, lifted up the dog's tail, and the cat was at the back of the dog, turned the dog on his back, and on the most sensitive, softest part of the dog, on his belly, put the cat on that, and the cat tried to scratch the dog, and the dog never moved. And the vet caught the cat back in the cage and said, see, your dog is dead. And the owner said, okay, I admit it now, because my dog would never tolerate that if he was alive. He would fight that cat, nor a cat, he never liked cats, he'd chase them, catch them and beat them up or whatever. So yeah, I admit it, the dog is dead. Good. So the vet runs out the door. $1,010. What? $1,000? I should hear for about 15 minutes. Yes, it was $10 for the consultation fee and $1,000 for the CAT scan. CAT scan. Okay, CAT scan. CAT. Yeah,
You can run it, okay, thank you so much.
Anyway, back to the
ghost story.
The dog is a true story, not a joke. So I went out to the dog, used the knife, and following the morning, this girl was sort of thinking about his dog. He opened the door of his house to go to work. There was a dog outside. It couldn't be his dog, because his dog was euthanized, lying in his arms. But it looked exactly the same. And it just rushed right past him into his house. And it went to every favorite corner of that house, curled up, and just slept for half a minute or so. Got up, went to another corner, went through the back door, which was always open, to get a drink from the leaky tap in the garden, where they would always get something to drink. And climbed upstairs, the owner was so stunned, he just let this dog do this. Went upstairs where his wife was still half asleep. And the dog would have this habit before he went in his owner's car to go to work, of leaning up and giving his owner's wife a kiss. And the owner's wife, half asleep, not realizing she was kissing a ghost, went over and kissed the dog. And the dog then ran outside, tried to get into the owner's car, and the owner said, "Enough, go." And the dog ran away. And they showed me photographs of this. It wasn't so dramatic, because he had his mobile camera to photograph this ghost dog, just like a real dog. And I thought, I was so cute, like a dog who came for one last visit to the home where he had lived most of his life, sleep on his favorite corners, drink from his favorite tap, and just one last kiss to his owner's wife before he vanished forever. That's the true story. Ghost dog. Real ghosts are never scary. They're actually really quite emotionally moving. So anyway, that's what happens. Even dogs, after they die, they don't just disappear. They can stay for a while. Cats the same. Okay. I'm never going to finish these questions when I carry on like this. Dear Angela, why is wrong view considered bad karma? Because when you have wrong view, good monks like me have to spend so much time arguing with you, and just, it's really bad karma to give out your wrong a hard time, and to make him die before his time is up, because he's arguing all these people who have wrong view. So a quick definition of what wrong view is, and wrong view is, that is in Ask Any of My Monks, Ajahn Brahmani, the first rule of Bodhinyana Monastery is the abbot, that's me, is always right. The second rule is, if he's wrong, go back to rule number one. Now that is right view. No, I tell you. Because sometimes wrong view, and why is there wrong view? And I probably mentioned this on the last retreat I was on. But I don't know if you I did suggest to you, if it's all possible, invite one of my best friends to come and give a talk. That was Bernard Carr. He was at the Ninth Global Conference because a great chance to catch up with him. Professor of theoretical physics at Queen Mary College in London, the treasurer of the Psychic Research Society in London, former good friend who hung out together when we were young, the first Buddhist I ever met was Bernard, so it was in the same thing. But he was also a close disciple, close one of Stephen Hawking's. In fact, when I had lunch with him in Cambridge last year, he had to leave early because he had to go and see Stephen to get permission for some new book he was writing. So I really close this up with Stephen Hawking. Stephen Hawking came to his wedding with his wife, Mary. So, close this up with Stephen Hawking's good friend of mine, physicist, Buddhist, into weird stuff like psychic stuff. And he told me this great experiment, and I keep mentioning this because this is evidence-based, the levitating flower pot at, Imperial College in London. Imperial College in London is really a very highly respected institution of scientific learning. And this professor, or this researcher, said he was going to demonstrate the levitation. And lots of sort of weirdos, to well-known scientists, fellow professors, people who were well-known experimenting physicists. Now he had the connections that he'd get people to actually attend. So there was all these old professors and doctors, well-known scientists, sitting in the lecture hall when he came in carrying a flower pot. He put it on the laboratory bench. You've all been to schools and universities, you've seen the bench they have in front. He put it on the bench and he said, this flower pot, you can see there's no wires, I bought it in myself. I'm now going to levitate this flower pot. There were cameras running to make sure that if it did happen, it was recorded. And he asked the cooperation of all in the audience. I need to get the right vibes in this room. I want you all to start chanting. And the first amazing achievement, this experiment who did this demonstration, was actually to get all these old professors to start chanting, I might be able to get you to do that, but professors in England at the top university to chant on when they're under 70 is an amazing achievement. So they're all chanting on, and the flower pot levitated. It actually rose into the air. There were no wires. It rose. And they filmed it. And afterwards, after some people saw this, there was a couple of these experimental scientists who wanted evidence-based proof for their theories, who were skilled in recording data, said it never limited. It was on the table all the time. It never moved. It was there. They showed the recording, no, that's fake. It never lifted. Even though anybody saw it. The point was, they had such a strong view that it cannot happen. It's against every law of science. That when it did happen, it never even registered to their conscious awareness. Now the backstory of this is that the day before, they had installed this huge, powerful electromagnet underneath the bench. It wasn't an experiment on levitation, it was an experiment on psychology. And they had to get everybody to chant OM, because whenever you put a large current to a machine, it hums. The OM was there to mask the huge electric current which was needed to levitate this little flower pot. It was a fake, and then there were many others. It was just electromagnetism, that is all. But the point was, for a couple of those professors, scientists, It was so against what they believed, they literally never came to their perception. It got filtered out before they hit even any awareness. Our problems, your view, filters out reality. You only allow into your consciousness what you want to see and hear. It goes so much against your views, you just don't even perceive it. It's just not there. That is quite troubling for what we think is objectivity. It also explains why people, they view stuff and they really think, I'm right and you're wrong. Be very careful. Don't just trust your senses. They can deceive you. Wrong view. So how do you get wrong view? How do you trust what you see, what you hear? That is the job of meditation. That is the job of letting go of what you want to see or hear. Letting go of the denial which refuses, has ill will, which blocks out stuff. Letting go of wishful thinking and denial. Ask any psychologist. You see what you want to see? You block out what is too confronting for you. Take those two away. One in meditation called the first two hindrances. Karma, chanda, maya, prana. When those two are gone, that's what meditation is supposed to do. Become still. Then your mind is peaceful, acts like a mirror, and doesn't distort the truth. That's one of the great things which I really appreciate with the Buddhist path. It doesn't tell you what right view is. It tells you how to find out. Be so still, there's no wanting, no ill will. So you see what's there, rather than what you want to see. Okay. When I meditate and I go into a dark space, like in outer space, is that good? Yeah, it sounds cool to me. The bed is quite calm and the bed in the background of this stage. Oh yeah, great, go for that. So the bed is fading away. You're away, you're going to a dark space, like outer space. Stay there, and the star will appear after a while. That's where it really gets cool. The mirrors, the lights in the night. And that's why I was telling someone today, that's what I really like talking about. Because that's the juicy part of meditation, really powerful stuff. Well, many of you just started meditating for the first time. So I just got to say, how to be peaceful, first of all. But what happens afterwards, ooh, that really blows you away. If you transport a fish from a river to an aquarium for education purposes, but the fish is unhappy, is it good merits or not? How do you know the fish is unhappy? You ask the fish. For me, I imagine the fish is much happier in an aquarium than in a river. Because in an aquarium, no one ever drops a fishing line in an aquarium, they do in a river. So imagine, just get your head around being a fish in the wild. You see a nice little worm swimming there, you don't know whether to trust that or not. That could be your last meal. Imagine you have supper, you don't know if there's a hook in the supper. And suddenly you get hooked out of the dining room and you disappear forever. Many fishes see that happen to their best friends. They're just enjoying lunch and boom, they're out of here. They'll never see it again. Imagine how traumatic that will be. You never enjoy your lunch, you don't know what's going to last long enough. So in an aquarium, you're totally free of that fear. And sometimes the poor fish in the rivers, they don't get anything to eat. But in an aquarium, three meals a day, you don't even go looking for it. It's like takeaway, you just start a piece and it's delivered to your door without room service. So the fish have room service three times a day. Also, in a river. Think about it. Sometimes the rivers are very cold. You got ice on the top. Aquariums, air conditioned, always at a constant temperature. You know what that is? Nice. What else is there? Oh yes, there's free health care. If a fish gets sick in the rivers, there's no one goes after them. They just take their chances. Most of them die. But in an aquarium, if you've got fish in an aquarium and they get sick, you get a fish doctor in. Those infects are coming out to heal your fish. So imagine like that. No fear of being fished by fishermen. Constant supply of food, nice and air conditioned, no worries at all. Yeah, you can't swim where you really want to go. That's just like keeping the five precepts, isn't it? You can't swim to where you want to go here in Phuket. You know, don't go to the town, there's many places you should go, okay? But keep finding more safe. So it's a trade off. And that's why I always say fish in the aquarium is so lucky. So, if I was a fish, I'd rather be in the aquarium than in the rivers. If we progress to our higher state and experience jhanas, etc., will we lose this in our next life? Do we pick up from where we left off? Yeah, we usually pick up from where we left off. Just like I mentioned that guy, Roy Hutt. He was a comic in his past life, he's a comic in this life. Very often you repeat, maybe not to the same level, maybe better than last time, what you did before. So the deep meditations, yes. That's why the Buddha, when he was a boy, could get jhanas under the Lhasa tree. Could you please in that way on your point about fear and how fears may come true? Thank you, Ajahn Bhav. One story that, actually, when I go back in July, there's one group, the Cancer Wellness Association. They started off the Cancer Support Association. They reminded me, I've been supporting them for about 27 years now. And every year they come to Bodhidharma Monastery, and once a year I go to their place for the afternoon, teach meditations and Buddhism. And never get any Christian priest going there, or Muslims or Jewish priests, or anything, just me. And they had this grand opening, because of the good service they do. The state government in Perth put about $5 or $6 million in this wonderful state-of-the-art campus. The then Premier of Western Australia opened it together with the second guest of honour, Ajahn Brahm. So, and I asked them, why me? Why do I have to keep coming to this place? And that's when they told me that there was one patient they had there. She was in remission for a cancer, but there was one question which no one was able to answer except when I came, and I answered straight away. They were so impressed, that's why they kept asking me to go back. What it was, this woman, she had, I think, a breast cancer, she was in remission, basically cured. But she was so anxious. What would happen if it came back? Knowing these days it's better, much better than it was 27 years ago, but still it's very traumatic, you know, to go through the treatment for a cancer. You know, it's really hard. The idea of having to go through that all over again was, you know, quite obviously traumatic for her. So she kept asking doctors, psychologists, psychiatrists for the answer. What would happen if he came back again? I don't think I could take it again. She was so afraid of it reoccurring. So when I came along and she asked that same question, what would happen if he came back again? Typical Ajahn Brahm, I said, what would happen if it didn't come back? And you know, she had appreciated that option before. It hits her, but she got it straight away. And she stopped worrying. Anxiety, fear is looking at the future with a negative mind. What would happen if? And then something goes wrong. And changing the future and looking at it with a positive mind, what would happen if it didn't go wrong? Which was far more likely. The odds were in her favor. So when I said that, what would happen if it didn't go wrong? Well, got the answer now. And for 26 years, the cancer has not come back. But she keeps coming back. She's so big. That was fear. And I told her, look, if you'd have carried on with that negative thought, what would happen if it came back? That anxiety would have caused so much stress. So the associated stress chemicals would be flowing through your veins 24/7 that would have reduced your immunity, you'd have got that cancer. The fear would have caused that cancer. What does fear do to your health? Another thing which I've noticed a lot, talking to people in relationships, they're afraid. What if my wife finds somebody else more money than I have? Because you're afraid, you don't relax and enjoy one another's company. It destroys the relationship. What you're afraid happening means you can't relax. And it makes what you fear actually happen. So fear is a terrible response to life, looking at the future with a negative mind. Because of that negativity, it creates so much pain. Anyway, how many years have you been a monk? Just this life or many lives before? Who knows? But anyway, this life, 42 years, and was it June? No, May now. Just 42 and a half years. And usually after 40 years you get something like a gold medal or a watch or something, I don't know. Me, don't get anything except more work. Sometimes you can work till the entire after 40 years, but me, because I haven't saved up any money because you haven't given me any in the first place, I have to keep working. There's no such thing as a free lunch for a monk. No tour, no lunch tomorrow for me. So 42 and a half years I've been a monk, and still going strong. Just getting into my stride of 42 years. Anyway, will all the donation after death create hatred or craving because of attachment to the body? No! You can donate your organ, your piano, your violin, whatever organ, music instrument. It's good to donate it to charity. That's what it meant, isn't it? Now, in your heart, your liver, is nothing wrong with that. As a human being, it's a wonderful thing to do. Please donate your organs, because you have no further use to them. If you donate your eyes when you're dead, in your next life you get super strong eyes, you maybe get the third eye. If you donate your liver, you probably get two livers, I don't know what you get. I want to donate my brain. And if I want to die suddenly, I want to donate my brain and see if the person who wakes up with my brain also tells stupid jokes. It's a part of my DNA or something else. Now, the reason it doesn't create hate or craving or attachment to the body, it creates inspiration. You've done a beautiful act, you saved other people's lives. Well done. Now, I did hear, it's only anecdotes, but please, if someone wants to check this out, in Spain, they don't have any dialysis clinics because they don't need them. They have so many kidney donors. If somebody, their kidneys fail, they can get a replacement almost straight away. And I remember in Malaysia, Canada, there are so many dialysis centers. And it's such a pain. Unnecessary. So many people are dying. You can get your kidneys. You aren't using them anymore. So please, be an organ donor. I've got my little card, which I carry around with me. And if I die, then you can have all my organs. The trouble with me these days, already it is happening, that anything which I touch, they wash it off. It's true, we have an auction over in Singapore and I go back, and they've got some stupid things of mine. You know, they're just my little inner robe, which I've cut up and sewn around teddy bears, and my meditation cushion. And I'd sat on that for, I think, almost 20 years, and I was auctioned in Hong Kong. You know how much for? $30,000 US. Oh, you are, yeah. And I was... Please, Andrew, just when I go, can we put this in the safe? This is horrible, a lot of money. So sometimes my organs, my dentist, who was an ex-Singaporean, my dentist, one of my tooth had cracked so he had to pull it out. Wouldn't he do it? Yes, you're right. He kept it as an investment, as a relic. The couple is, maybe after a bit of a dodgy intentions, that when he moved his office, or his surgery to another place, a different location, he lost it, couldn't find it, disappeared. So I'm a bit scared of going to him again. Where he said, oh, I need to take your teeth out. Why? Why? Anyway, but yeah, keep things, do your job and give your orders. During the meditation, how is being compassionate to feelings that are, that arise, different from being kindful to them? This is saying the same word, kindfulness, compassion. But be careful, because sometimes the kindness is not wise. You see somebody in hospital and you say, may you be well and happy. Don't put more pressure on them to get better. And they feel such a failure that it doesn't work for them. They try so hard to get well, it makes them sick. So instead, when I go to see someone in hospital, I say, may you get better, or may you stay sick, whatever you want, I will still be your friend. I don't want to force you. When you meet someone and say, have a good day, that is just so un-Buddhist to say, have a good day. What's wrong with having a bad day? Sometimes I have a bad day, you have a bad day, sometimes I have a good day. So you feel such a failure when you have a bad day. So I want to give people freedom. Having a bad day is okay. Bad day is your right to have a bad day from time to time. So these days when people are seeing they have a good day or a bad day, whichever you want. I am not going to force you or control you. So this evening, have a nice night's sleep if you want to. You don't have to. It's quite okay, you're allowed to have a bad night's sleep. It's not going against any rules or precepts, and sometimes that happens. So stop stigmatizing being sick or being unhappy. That's why the US version of the one good guy who knows is called Don't Worry, Be Grumpy. That's a title, Don't Worry, Be Grumpy. That comes from the fact, what's wrong with being grumpy? Sometimes you are grumpy. So please, allow yourself to be grumpy. Be happy to be grumpy. And anyway, look, you know all about Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs? You know all about Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs? You know the statistics have proven beyond a shadow of doubt that 6 out of 7 dwarfs are not happy. Six out of seven dwarfs are happy. Okay. So big compassion to feelings is open the door of your heart to those feelings. Be a friend to them. And a good friend is there for you when you're unhappy, when you're sick, you're not having a good time. And they still be your friend, even if you're unhappy. So you be a friend to your body, even when it's sick. Faith is growing your quote, patience is waiting in the moment, impatience is waiting in the future in your body. Yeah, of course, it's waiting for something to happen. You know, that's so common in meditation. I teach all those stages of meditation. I get waiting for it to happen, waiting for it to happen, waiting for it to happen. It never happens. Why? Because you're not in the present moment. Waiting in the future. That's called waiting for it to happen. So, it's wanting something. Actually, Mom says, I'll follow the instructions and I'll get peaceful. You're not following the instructions. You're waiting for it to happen. It's happening right now. You're missing it. Here's a young monkey time. It was very tough. We'd hardly ever see any tea or coffee or sugar. I did only eat once a day. But whenever we were dying our robes of such hard physical work, they were allowed to have tea and coffee in the dying shed to help. We only had a small amount, so we couldn't have it all the time. So, a few of my friends were up all night dying their robes. And I woke up about and fell bed at 3 a.m. in the morning. 3 a.m. I used to get up. Now I only get up at 4 o'clock. I've really gone slack. But that day, I woke up at 2:30 a.m. And I thought, 2:30, if I go to the dying shed now, they're my friends. It's great in the world, we've got a really big time. I looked after them, I'm sure they'll make me a cup of tea or coffee. First thing in the morning. I said, no, that's just craving, that's indulging, that's just following my sexual desires. That's what I thought. But as you all know, that's not enough to stop you going to the dying shed. So I went walking to the dying shed, and on the way, I could hear the 3 o'clock bell ring. When I got to the dying shed, it was over, it was finished. It was all calm. I realized I was too late. They finished earlier than I expected, so I went to the morning chanting, half asleep, tired. And after the arms round had finished, those monks came up and said, Ajahn, where were you at 3 o'clock when the bell rang? I said, well, I knew I was walking on the dining shed to get a cup of tea or coffee from you guys. Oh, what a shame, they said, because we were bringing you a cup of tea. But they came on a different route. So because of my craving, I was searching. So if I just stayed put, it would have come to me. But I always remember that, like the heavenly beings were teaching me something. You go searching and chasing for it, it never comes. You sit down and relax, and it comes to you. That's called waiting in the moment, or waiting in the future. Not going out looking for it. Stay in the home. It's like on Singapore Airlines. It's called the inside service. You don't even need to ring the bell. People come to see you and say, "Sir, what can I get you?" On the menu on this flight, we have 1st John, 2nd John, 3rd John, 4th John. Would you like to listen? And because 70th anniversary is in the highlight, we have special psychic powers for every person's John, or every John. So then I'm all you know, I'll say it's on the last flight, so I'm on the 3rd John, and I'll be certainly, sir. Just wait a moment. Who's like power of Father? Remember past lives, reading moments? They never get more meditation because that would have come to the process of sinning. That's how it works. That's not waiting in the peace, not going out for it, but staying at home. And it comes to you. Wow. It's almost, you haven't even got time, it's almost 10 to 10. Look, Angie, she's gone to bed already. Right over there. How come we didn't see? I don't know where you are. There's something over there in the back. Anyway, a couple more questions. You okay? Okay. My husband is a Christian and his belief in the afterlife are different from mine as a Buddhist. What happens then when we die? The first thing you do when you die, go and find your husband, find out where he's been before, and tell him, "I told you so." I'm sure he did. When a person dies, how long does it take to be reborn? Does the date of dying define the date of rebirth? No, not necessarily. It depends on when you want to be reborn. If you've got the unfinished business, like, tell me what, two questions.
Why this Thai lady?
She was married to a Chinese man in birth. Now this Thai lady, she was, I don't know how you explain these things. She was, you know, what we used to sort of call a battle axe, really hard woman to live with. Always criticizing her husband George in public. "George, you stupid man, come here. George, you're over there. George, you're not good enough." She said it in public. And I felt so sorry for George, but you know, when this prince-like lady died, I said, "You must be so happy." And I said, "No, I miss her so much." Amazing attachment. Even people who drive you crazy give such a hard time. You get so used to them, you get attached to them, and you miss them afterwards. But anyway, she came up with one. She said, "I'm going to die soon. The doctor's confirmed it. I don't trust my stupid husband, George. He's so incompetent. I can't trust him to arrange a funeral for me. I said, well, can you do it for me?" "I'm very helpful. I'll arrange your funeral, your marriage, bless your babies, get rid of your dose. I'm such a good, kind-hearted one that people take advantage of me. But that's what I'm born for, to be taken advantage of." So anyway, so yeah, sure. But, and she said, "If you do the funeral for me, then pay for it. So why not my money, but you're in your temple. Then I will bequeath 50% of my small units." And I think at that time it was worth about $60,000-$70,000, and a funeral will cost about $6,000 or $7,000. So, you know, it was actually, I told that to my committee, and we just said, "Well, this makes a lot of business sense." That's what they thought. So we agreed. So I did the funeral for her, paid for everything, $6,000 or $7,000. There'll be repaid when we get half of the house. But after the funeral, as soon as the, you know, the body was cremated, we did go around to the husband, "Hey, George, cough up. You owe us $30,000. "We're not like that. You know, I would never be part of the Buddhist community who was just so money orientated." So they waited a considerable time. And I treasured just for, "George, if you found it anywhere yet?" He said, "Why? I can't find it anywhere. I've looked everywhere for it. I can't find it." But a week later, "You found it?" "Oh no, I can't find it. It's disappeared." And then one day, early in the morning, George came in a taxi So Bodhinyana Monastery. That's a lot of money, a taxi, all the way from Perth to Bodhinyana Monastery. He got out of the taxi, I've never seen, honestly, never seen anyone so scared in my life. He was terrified. He had a piece of pavement and an envelope. Here, that's a rock, take it now, quick. It was a will. I just found it. I knew where it was all the time. I didn't want to give it to you. But last night, in the middle of the night, my wife came. Go, jaw this stupid man, get that will now, give it to Ajahn Brahm now. And that, I felt so sorry for him. I've never seen someone so afraid. He couldn't give that will to me fast enough. Again, you know, he didn't want to give it, he was greedy. But when the Krishna, the ghost, realized she's had some unfinished business to get her stupid husband to give the will to me, that's what she had to do. So be very careful. If any of you bequeath anything to Bodhinyana or the Dharma Center or my center, and if you don't cough up, I have many friends in the ghost world. You know the promise. You wake up in the middle of the night. Because King of the world, King Brahm said to your request, hang up. That's a true story, but I felt so sorry for George. Never seen someone so bad. So that's not what happens. Get the unfinished business out of the way, then you can go off and have a nice night. How do we explain to our children the current state of the world where the corrupt evil of mass is thriving at the expense of whole something, and its future generations? How do we guide them to stay on the right path when the corrupt and evil continues to live and enjoy life while they suffer for being good? Am I corrupt or am I good? Do I suffer? No way. So don't think that the good suffer. Stupid suffer. For the wise people, the kind people, they will never suffer, no matter what happens in this world. Here is the stupid people. We don't call it evil people, we call it stupid people. They just harm themselves and harm other people. That's all. There's corrupt, yeah, there's lots of corruption as well, there's lots of goodness as well. So don't just focus on the two bad bricks in the wall. If you want to see the two bad bricks in the wall, just watch the 6 o'clock news. They don't focus on the good bricks in the wall, in the 6 o'clock news. But those bricks are there. It's not all corrupt. When was the last time I told a story about that big donation in California? I don't know if you heard that, but anyway, I was a couple of years ago when I was visiting California, story of this gentleman driving in his car and in a part of California with a very bad internet reception. No mobile phone towers. So his car broke down by the side of the road, he couldn't call anyone to help him. He was stuck. There's many parts of Australia where like that. Such a huge country, you can't have sort of good access everywhere. So I was told this, that part of the culture, if you're in one of the remote areas and you pass somebody, you always stop to help them, always. Because that could be you. I remember years ago we passed this couple, and you know, this was this roundabout ways of Bodhinyana Monastery. An old couple had actually, the car had broken down. They spent all night in their car in the middle of the forest because there's no way of getting any coverage there, so they got someone to help them. And I came there early in the morning to go to the wood yard to pick up some wood for building something. We stopped, and they were just so happy to see us. And all we needed to do was to jump start the battery of their car, they'd go off again. No giving anybody time, so please go and see us. You know, just save them. They were so terrified, this poor old couple. But anyway, that's what you do. Anyway, this guy was stuck in the middle of nowhere, and a fire passed by, so what's the problem? The and something wrong with the car. And if you're a farmer, you know, you know basic car mechanics, and so you could fix that problem. And so they showed, said thank you, and the farmer went back to his farm, and the driver of the car went back to where he was going. And a week later, or thereabouts, the farmer got a letter from his bank. All his debts, his home loans, farm loans, have already paid off. And a substantial amount of money have been deposited in his credit account. Because the man whose car had stopped was no other than Bill Gates. Celebrities, I heard that this was also one of the Brad Pitt's. So he likes just going in his car and just driving by himself, because it's the only time he can be around a normal human being. They can't see who's driving the car. If he goes into a restaurant or a shop or walks down the street, he's instantly recognizable. Then his car is anonymous. That's why he rushes going out driving anywhere just to be free. So probably the same with Bill Gates. He can afford a chauffeur, but it just likes the freedom of just being himself. That's what happened. And of course, you know, he doesn't take any cash with him, but he took down the number plates of the farmer. You know, being Bill Gates, and basically do whatever he wants. Find out, you know, who that car belongs to. Find out his bank details. Find out he was in debt. So decided to do something he could do. Just probably wouldn't even notice the amount of money which he deposited in the farmer's account, but for the farmer, all his debts paid off, a big amount of money, instant karma, just because he was kind. So please, if ever you see somebody stuck by the side of the road in Singapore, actually Singapore's not really that big a place, in Thailand, you come to visit me in Australia, you don't know who he could be. Okay, anyway, that's good news. There is some good stuff going on. Last question, may I finish off? If we put a dog down when it is suffering, I mean, mention that again, put the ladder down. I always put a dog down, it's too heavy. If you put a dog, actually I saw that with Prince Philip. Remember, he's got good sense of humor. He announced he was standing down. All his duties. And I said, why are you standing down? So I'm too old to stand up. If you put a dog down when it is suffering, or stop treatment if a person terminally ill, do they have to continue to pay back in their next life? Did we shorten their suffering prematurely? No. If I break my leg because I fall off the stage, and you say, no, I better not send that in front of the hospital. I better not give him any painkillers. It's his karma. I've got to let him work out his karma. That is called stupidity. If there's something you can do, please do it. If you can help, please help. So the idea of karma is not, oh, it's your karma to have to break your leg. It's also your karma you have friends and loved ones who look after you. It's your karma you live in a land where there's many hospitals and doctors. There's many doctors here. So if you are sick, if you do break your leg, please get healed. And give the doctors an opportunity to make some good karma by helping you. Give the chemical companies who make aspirin the chance to make good, give them lots of bad karma. Medical companies, but at least they can make some good karma by getting rid of your pain. And please dedicate the fruit of that good karma whenever you take the medicine that it works. So all those people work hard to try and alleviate your suffering. So, it's not that the dog hasn't paid off his karma yet, so has to live again and get cancer again. No. It's a beautiful thing. The person who turned me on, you're not stopping them. Was it burning off on their bad karma? You're teaching them the beauty of good karma. So, please, if I keep on serving the same way, thank you very much. Christ was nobody accounted. Each one of them was part of the people always on the one, never staying in one place at the same time. Anyway, if ever I keep telling the same story, the same joke again, time after time again, please put me down. I will confess you to everybody else. Okay, I think that's enough for this evening. It's almost 10 o'clock, the time you should. Are you going to go out and have supper? Promise. Okay. Okay, then thank you all for listening. Sadhu.
Sadhu.
Let's spend an opening round of drink coffee. One, two, three. Sadhu.
Sadhu. Sadhu.
Thank you, Ajahn Brahm. I'm going to be stepping you down on the stage. Okay. So just checking how many...